ABC National in Australia has a flagship program called The Science Show with Robin Williams. The host understands science and scientists, and he gets them talking with disarming honesty. You can get the program regularly online or by podcast. Here is Britain's chief scientist, Sir David King, with Robin Williams on October the 18th, 2007. It's radio you need to hear.
Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Good evening, Robin Williams with another In Conversation, this time with a chief scientist. Australia has a few in Queensland, South Australia, Western Australia, and federally, of course, but not yet in New South Wales. However, our guest today is Britain's chief scientist, who happens to be a South African. Sir David King has come to Australia again to attend a climate summit in Sydney and to talk about his Hippocratic Oath for scientists. That'll be later. But welcome, Sir David. Your conference started with a bang, an announcement from CSIRO forecasting Australia's climate prospects. Were you alarmed by the severity of what they had to say?
Not at all. I don't think for me that there were any surprises. I think the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, the international body, has produced a report which contains some of the material that was published in more detail, as one would expect, for the continent of Australia. So I think, no, there were not too many surprises. What we all need to understand is that the scientists have moved on very significantly over the last 10 years. We understand much more clearly what the likely impacts are going to be over the next 10, 20, 50, 100 years, continent by continent, region by region, city by city. Critically important information, because this is required for governments to put in place policies that will enable them to manage the impacts of climate change. Here in Australia, already you're experiencing lower rainfalls in areas where you would like to have much more rain. Now, how do you manage these impacts? And this is a situation that has to be taken on board region by region. We in Britain are already handling our impacts, which are very largely driven by the fact that our rainfall has changed already and will continue to change. We're seeing more torrential rainfall and less of that old English drizzle that we used to have. Good in terms of the percentage of sunshine we get, but not good because our drainage system doesn't cope with this rainfall and we get flash floods in our cities. So we're having to spend, at the moment, £500 million a year on a program to manage this process. But that will rise in 3 years to £700 million a year and continue to rise through the century. The British scientific effort, based through the Meteorological Office, is mapping out the impacts around the world, and that is being done region by region. So we can help every country through these very sophisticated models to develop coping strategies. But of course, the other side to this is that if you take these models to the end of the century, you'll see the coping strategies become extremely difficult, almost beyond many countries to manage, if we have a business as usual scenario. So what's absolutely critical as well is that we get in place a global agreement to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. And we've got a very short amount of time to manage that.
Yes, I was going to say that the IPCC was talking about possibilities of 6 degrees increase. Now, the CSIRO came up with 5 by 2070. In a situation where an increase of 1.5 degrees, which is almost inevitable as it looks, or 2 degrees, even 2 degrees is severe, so 5 makes one feel it's time to give up.
Yes. I mean, if we look at 5 in the world's past history, when did we see a 5-degree temperature change? You have to go right back into the last ice age. So the sort of temperature difference we're talking about in the future, of course, going up, is similar to the temperature difference between a warm period and a typical ice age. So what this means is that the world's climate system will change radically. If you just take one country, India, India's totally dependent on the monsoon. If the monsoon fails 1 year, that means, the word failure implies less than 10% of average rainfall, then they have massive crop failure. If the monsoon 10% exceeds the average, they have massive flooding. So they're critically dependent on that monsoon. Now, nobody believes that a temperature rise of 3, 4, 5 degrees isn't going to have an enormous impact on that monsoon. Now again, go country by country and you'll see the same story. So what, there's no question, we have to avoid anything that would lead to a 5, 6, 7 degree temperature rise. And what that means is that we've got to take action quickly to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. If we don't start seeing a turnaround in emissions, we're rising year on year at the moment, if we don't see a turnaround within the next 5 years, then we are beginning to write off our future, really quite severely.
How much time do you think we've got, according to the forecast? 10 years?
We haven't got 10 years to sit back and think about this. What we must have in place by 2009 is an international agreement. And that international agreement must have a stabilisation level that all governments say, yes, that's the level beyond which we don't want to go for all greenhouse gases in our atmosphere. It must have an agreement country by country of trajectories towards lower carbon dioxide levels. And for a country like Australia, for a country like Britain, that means a virtually linear decrease over the next 50 years. No pause, we have to turn around and start decreasing our emissions. For a country like India, that might mean a trajectory which allows some increase in emissions, but with a subsequent fall in emissions. So we have to look at trajectories country by country. But the other part of the agreement that is essential, and we mustn't avoid talking about, is how do we manage it globally? What do we do with a country that decides, no, it's not worth doing because the rest of the world can manage the problem? Well, we have to introduce a fiscal process, an economic process. So putting a price on carbon dioxide, putting a cap country by country, squeezing the cap every 3 years is the way to do it, because you then introduce carbon dioxide as a trading commodity. And I believe the problem then gets passed back to countries to reduce their own emissions. They would have to introduce a raft of regulations to manage that, just as Britain is doing at the moment. And finally, and this is also critically important, we need to develop a strategy for dealing with the poorly developed countries, countries in Africa, for example, that will not be able to afford to manage the impacts of climate change. We need to help them with that. And we need to help them with their technology transfer. So any agreement has to have those critical four elements. Can we get it in place by 2009? I'm an optimist. I think we have to do it.
Well, indeed, Jeremy Leggett, who I think you know on The Science Show a couple of weeks back, was saying some unkind things about Tony Blair and the gap between the wonderful florid words versus the hard commitment. Now, we have a new Prime Minister in Britain, Gordon Brown. Do you get the inkling he is taking this challenge of 2009 seriously?
Yes. To be honest, I would have to say that Gordon Brown is a person who takes everything seriously. You know, he's been faced in his initial period as Prime Minister with a whole series of challenges. We've had very severe floods, we've had a foot and mouth disease outbreak, we've had blue tongue, and his popularity in Britain has gone up with each of the crises, precisely because he approaches them with such seriousness. I think there's no question he takes climate change seriously. It was Gordon Brown who in 1998 introduced the climate change levy, the first of its kind anywhere. And that levy was critical. It produced funding for the Carbon Trust, about £110 million a year, funding for the Energy Efficiency Trust, and that was a very important part of setting us on the road towards reducing our greenhouse gases.
Now, there have been some people who have suggested that your own comments have been too extreme. One of them I seem to remember is Dr. Kinnunmoth, who's, should we say, a sceptic. And he quotes you these days as saying that, I think you said this in 2004, at least it suggested you did, that there might be a stage when the only inhabitable place on Earth will be Antarctica. Do you remember saying that?
I certainly didn't say that. I've been totally misquoted many, many times. Always pleased to have the opportunity to correct the statement I made. What I did say was that if you go back 55 million years, it's in the paleological record that Antarctica was a tropical forest. And at that point in time, if you wanted to have some real estate, and these were my words, you would want it in Antarctica because the rest of the world was pretty damn hot. So that has been extrapolated to me saying that if we keep going in this way, there will only be people left living in Antarctica. Now, to be honest, if we burnt all of the fossil fuels, and I don't believe we're going to be as silly as all that, but if we burnt all of the fossil fuels, all of the coal that we have at our disposal, it is quite possible that in a few thousand years, we could get the planet back to that state it was in 55 million years ago. But I don't believe that's going to happen.
Well, some of the things that have come out of people sceptical about these points that you're making, do you think that kind of opposition to the message about the severity of what we face, that sort of opposition is diminishing now in Britain and as far as you know, in Australia?
The voices of these so-called scientific sceptics, and I say so-called, I'm actually questioning whether they're scientists, have now been quenched. You don't hear much from them anymore. Basically, the weight of the evidence that comes in from the scientific community, the truly scientific community, is so overwhelming. When people see the sophistication of the experiments, you know, how do we measure, for example, the rate of loss of Greenland ice? We send up two satellites, one satellite monitoring the movement of the satellite in front of it, and we measure accurately the change in the gravitational field of the satellite as the satellite goes over Greenland, experiencing the melting of the Greenland ice. As the ice melts, the gravitational field gets slightly smaller, and we're measuring it with enormous accuracy. So we know how much ice is being lost from Greenland. By the way, that number is around 200 cubic kilometres of ice, summer ice, each year. That's quite a big chunk of ice. Now, that's a measurement. It's an accurate measurement. We can't sit down and say, well, this is a bit extreme. It may sound extreme, but it's a very important piece of the jigsaw of science that's being put together. So all of the original serious sceptical points that were raised, and scientists will always challenge each other, particularly when a model is initially being tested. The points that were raised have all been tested. So, for example, one of the scientists said, as the seas warm up, yes, water vapor rises above them, and water vapor itself is a greenhouse gas, so we get more heating up than just from the carbon dioxide. But, he said, in the higher troposphere, we could get an inversion of water vapor. It could be less, and that would exactly cancel out the effect of the lower atmosphere water vapor increase. Satellite measurements done, absolutely wrong. The water vapor increase in the troposphere is in line with all of the climate change models that have been produced. So each of these points skeptics have raised, real points of skepticism, have now been checked, and they've been found absolutely in line with existing models. So I think it's right to understand that scientists challenge each other, but they challenge until we have a really concrete piece of work, and then we move on. And where have we moved to now? We've moved to the very practical point of trying to understand in more detail exactly what the impacts will be region by region. That's what is the big demand on the scientists. We're no longer at the point of discussing, is this anthropogenic? Is this because we're using fossil fuels? Is it because of deforestation? That is all well understood. And we've now moved into a much more interesting debate about exactly what will the impacts be.
Has that been behind the possibly change of attitude of both John Howard and George W. Bush?
You know, I can't read the minds of other people, but certainly the weight of evidence, scientific evidence behind this is a big factor. Australian scientists and American scientists are amongst the leaders in the scientific group producing this weight of evidence and information. And I would suggest, ill behove a politician to ignore what the scientific community are saying. If the scientific community, for example, were to say, there's a potential H5N1 epidemic around the corner and you should prepare for this, Prime Minister, I would think the Prime Minister would need to take notice.
That's flu, of course.
That's flu. And I'm simply saying all Prime Ministers do take notice of that, and they also will take notice of climate change science, won't they?
That's from ABC International host Robin Williams with Sir David King, the chief scientist for the UK. with important climate news that I wanted to pass on to you. You can find out more at their website at abc.net.au/rn. The RN stands for Radio National.